Welcome to Indie Film Weekly on April 28th, 2016. I'm Liz Nord, editor-in-chief of No Film School.
I'm Ryan Koo, founder of No Film School.
I'm Emily Booter, managing editor.
And I'm John Fusco, a producer-editor.
This week will be our special Tribeca Film Festival episode, bringing you a wrap-up of the past 2 weeks of adventures from Lower New York and some wrap-up from the National Association of Broadcasters show that we were also at in Las Vegas.
So this is the first episode where all of the New York staff are here in our sound booth. We're excited to be back from Las Vegas, Nevada, where John Fusco and I covered the National Association of Broadcasters trade show. I believe we will end up having over 100 videos going live from there. We're still editing. We saw a lot of stuff, and Micah Van Hove and I did a podcast about NAB, and Micah said, cameras are done, and we sort of felt that was accurate. And then the next day, I went and did an in-depth demo with Lytro, whose cinema camera was announced at NAB. I'll talk about that more later, but suffice it to say, cameras are no longer done. And now we're here in the sound booth with Emily and Liz because Tribeca was going on at the same time, which is sort of like a nightmare for No Film School, but it's also kind of amazing. So you guys are going to tell us the movies you saw, the interviews you did, and we're all going to talk about the festival in general. Let's start with the overall festival experience. Tribeca this year, what did you guys think?
Well, we really missed you guys, first of all. You were with us at the beginning, and we'll get into some of that, but you know, it was pretty exciting to know that No Film School was basically covering the entire spectrum of major film activities across the country during these last couple weeks. We were definitely holding down the fort here. We saw tons of films between us and did lots of interviews. You guys did a couple too, and we also had some more writers on hand, so there's lots to discuss, I would say.
Oh, but we also did something else that I almost forgot about it because it seems so long ago. We partied.
Yeah, woo! That's true. We definitely partied.
Yeah, we did.
No Film School had our first official film festival party.
We partnered with Actor Martinez by Nate Silver and Mike Ott, and Always Shine by Sophia Tikal. Of all the parties that I've been to recently, industry parties, it was definitely very open and positive, and people were talking to each other, and everyone felt approachable. It was a really good vibe.
And we did that party not just for ourselves, but we did it for a couple of films that we felt were good representatives of the indie film scene. Emily, why don't you talk a little bit about those two films?
Okay, yeah. So we partnered with Actor Martinez, which is a very interesting movie, which it could be described as docu-fiction, but even the co-directors, don't know whether or not it's scripted.
What does that mean exactly? The co-directors and directors don't know if it's not scripted? What is that?
They went into it with an outline, a 3-page long outline, and then they recruited two actors to basically just play themselves, and they injected some drama into it, sort of like a reality television show, and the directors played themselves too. So you never really get the sense that anybody is fully acting or fully playing themselves. It exists somewhere in between, and that's what's really interesting about it.
Which section of the festival did it play in, narrative or documentary?
It played in Viewpoints, I believe.
And that's a narrative section?
Yes. It was definitely not a documentary, but it felt very documentary-like, which was why it was kind of a trip.
So the Actor Martinez folks actually rounded themselves up and left our party directly to their premiere that evening. And we were left with a whole, you know, bunch of really fun people, including the cast and crew of Always Shine, which was our other co-producer on the party. And their film premiered the following night.
So I saw Always Shine, and, you know, Sophia is a well-known actor in the indie scene. Always Shine is the story of two actresses who go to a retreat together and, you know, maybe think they're going to have a relaxing time, and then lots of underlying tensions come to the fore. So Sophia directed the film. She's not in it, and it's really great. she's absolutely the real deal as a director. It is a unique voice in the industry. It feels personal. It feels true. It lost me a little bit at the end. It gets pretty meta at the end. But sometimes with a movie directed by an actor, you can tell how cognizant they are of performances. And Caitlin Fitzgerald and Mackenzie Davis are both outstanding in it. And I believe Mackenzie Davis took home an award?
Yep, she won Best Actress.
It was a great year for female-helmed films in general. I think that was a big item that made Tribeca stand out from other festivals this year. Actually, one third of the features this year were directed by women, which was more than Sundance and Toronto, and way more than Cannes, the upcoming Cannes Festival, which has only 15% of films directed by women. So Tribeca is really going out of its way, and a lot of them were really, really good. I saw a few. Sophia Takal is actually a film fatale. It's part of it's a women's film collective that I'm part of, and several film fatales films were in the festival, so I had to, you know, support my sisters. And thank goodness the films were actually great. You know, I think we've all had the experience of trying to go support friends or colleagues' films, and then you're like, nice color grading. am I right? but these were really good. One that stuck out, I had put in our post about films we're excited to see at the festival, was Love True by Alma Harrell, which was this just really inventive documentary. Not even a documentary, kind of like Emily was saying. I feel like we're catching on to a trend here of these like doc fiction hybrids, but this one's more on the documentary side in that it's telling true stories, but it weaves these stories with psychodrama reinterpretations, like filmed psychodrama reinterpretations of the cast members' memories. It's hard to explain. You have to see it yourself, and you won't be surprised when you do to learn that Alma Harrell started her career as a music video director. And I have to say that this was one of those cases where not only was the film fascinating, but the interview just made it all the more interesting. The interview is going to go up this week, and basically Harrell's whole story behind the story of getting it produced by Shia LaBeouf, who she directed in a Sigur Rós music video before, and also of how, this is the craziest part, she broke her back during filming and kept shooting from a wheelchair. She shot the film herself. So it's just the movie's wild, the story's wild. I highly recommend it.
Is it all of a sudden a lot of low angle, or what happens at that point?
It's interesting you said that. I didn't really notice, since I didn't know the story really until afterwards, but now on going back, I'll have to check it out.
So speaking of female-directed films, I actually saw a very interesting film from Estonia, which was in the newly minted international category, which was separate this year from the American narrative category at Tribeca.
Right, and that was the first for Tribeca. Typically, they grouped them all together. And Liz and I talked about previously how maybe that was an objective of the festival, to give American narratives their own platform and maybe compete with other festivals that way.
Yeah. So this film was directed by a woman and co-written by two other women. It's called Mother, and it was a take on the Coen brothers' Fargo narrative. It was a bit of a murder mystery, but the main magic in it was definitely in the stoic tension. So it took place in a house, and it was basically entirely in this one house. As a mother cares for her comatose son, and villagers from the small village come and one by one visit and speak to the son and reveal parts of themselves and parts of the town's narrative. And it was very confidently directed, and that was actually one of the best films I saw this year there.
So when you say it's a take on Coen brothers, you mean tone-wise?
Tone-wise, yes, okay. Definitely. It was directed by a woman named Kadri Kowasar, and I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce her last name perfectly.
This is the problem with podcasts.
Yeah.
We're used to being writers.
Yeah.
No, the real problem is that none of us know how to speak Estonian, which is something we really need to work on here at No Film School.
All right, John, that's all you.
I got it.
So a third of the movies at Tribeca were directed by women, and half of this podcast is hosted by women. I'd like to talk about that statistic. It's 50%. I'm really good at math, guys.
I feel good about that one.
Eat that, Tribeca. I mean, there's so many more films to talk about. John, what about you? What did you see before you ran off to Las Vegas?
So I saw, I guess I was like running around for maybe 2 days with nonstop with a huge bag of mics and arms and podcasting equipment and a Zoom.
In a bag of arms?
A bag of arms. freaked some of the press people out, but we were actually something I found interesting was we were actually some of the only group of, I guess, reporters to have this kind of equipment and be mobile enough to go around to press rooms and just set up a podcast station in like 10 minutes. So that was really
Tribeca
cool.
Tribeca has really nice press rooms, though, and we're here in New York on like some publications that maybe wouldn't fly across the country with mics and stands.
Right.
And so it's an advantage to being in New York.
Yeah, and you know, when you have a dedicated and built enough producer to be running around the city with a bag full of equipment.
Right. For those of you who haven't seen John Fusco, he's just swole.
Yeah, yes. His name should be Jacked Fusco.
Yes. Well, that's my grandfather's name, but... Anyways, I saw Nerdland, which was probably the standout, I'd say, out of the four or five movies that I saw, just because it was so insane. And I love Adult Swim, and I love the production company Titmouse Incorporated, which produced the film. And the director of the film was actually the founder of Titmouse. Titmouse does these pretty much now they're classic Adult Swim cartoons like Super Jail, Metalocalypse, China Illinois, all those really out there adult animated cartoons.
And is Nerdland an animated feature?
Yeah, it's an animated feature. So it's Chris Pronosky, who's the director. This was his first feature-length animated film, but it manages to sort of like keep the tone of these like really fast-paced, intense adult cartoons. So it was really interesting seeing how that translated into the feature-length format.
It's interesting because I ran into a couple of people on the subway on their way back from the premiere, and they hated it,
yeah.
And they wanted to walk out. So why do you think people would hate it?
Well, it's a super controversial movie, I think, in that sense, because it's really gratuitously disgusting, I'd have to say, at points. I mean, it's literally there's one part where one of the protagonists bends over as he's trying to interview this other character, and then he farts and his pants rip open and then his boxers rip open, and then he farts again, and it's like a zoom in on his, like, you see his butthole like contract and open.
I'm glad to hear this is animated, though. You talked about that on the podcast with them, though, about how it's
a benefit of the animated format
that you'd probably prefer to see,
right?
You
wouldn't want to see that live. I mean, I don't think that would be able to be.
And what is the animation style? I'm assuming this is not photorealistic.
No, it's hand drawn, which is another really interesting part about this movie, is that it's so layered and so complex. They would actually go in after sort of like a first pass with the animation of each frame, and then like look for places where certain things were missing, and then they just add detail and add detail and add detail and keep going back. And there's some really funny Easter eggs and like crazy things that you can pick up on if you watch close enough.
And that's interesting because Andrew Kevin Walker, the writer, had he written animated stuff before? He written huge
no,
movies.
No, yeah.
Right?
So he wrote Seven, which is another like one of my personal favorites. but he'd never written an animated movie, and this actually wasn't even intended to be animated. It was intended to be a live action movie.
So they were gonna do the boxer ripping zoom in.
I have no idea.
He did
about
write
that.
Seven, which is has got some
pretty over the top.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm like. It really you wouldn't think about like marrying the two like collaborators together, but it really worked, I thought.
So stay tuned because that podcast is coming out after this podcast.
Yeah, coming out on Monday. So.
Seems like that's not the only weird film that was in Tribeca this year. I kind of like that. It seemed like the programmers were taking a lot of risks. Tribeca's gotten some criticism in years past for sort of veering too much mainstream, like as though it was trying to be too much of a scene type of festival. And it is a scene. There are celebrities. There were celebrity-helmed films this year. I mean, Katie Holmes directed one of the films. And I know, Emily, you interviewed Danny DeVito. But it does seem like several of these films were weird outliers in a great way. Like another one I saw was Women Who Kill by another local female film fatale director, Ingrid Jungerman, and that ended up winning Best Screenplay, but it's a pretty weird movie. It's like about women who do a podcast about serial killers, about female serial killers, and then the film itself turns into this sort of, if possible, dryly comic lesbian love story slash murder mystery in and of itself. So it's definitely not your typical film, and Ingrid has a kind of unique voice and perspective.
She came from web series, didn't she?
Yeah, she and I actually did a talk together for Tribeca because we were both Tribeca grantees, and that web series of hers, F to Seventh, is now potentially going to be a TV series on Showtime, as she just signed a development deal. So congratulations to Ingrid.
Woo! What other weird ones did you guys see? Or just, you know, interesting ones?
I saw another weird movie. There's...
and that's this week's New Film Weekly. Right?
So the other podcast that I did was also another weird movie. It's this anthology film called Holidays. And we've been talking a lot about, like, omnibus and anthology films.
What's the difference?
I still have no idea.
Okay. Anthology are the same thing.
They're the same thing. One just sounds more... I guess, more intelligent.
They both sound pretty intelligent.
Scratch that. They're different.
Well, since we have the internet in this sound booth, I looked it up. Oh. And it says, the difference between anthology and omnibus is that anthology is a collection of literary works, such as poems or short stories, while omnibus is a vehicle set up to carry many people.
So you didn't actually read the definition before.
No, I just started reading that, but that was my radio voice, and I thought it sounded like it was going somewhere, and our apologies because it didn't.
I can define what omnibus is.
Okay, yeah, do it.
So the omnibus film is essentially a bunch of directors' take on a single theme or place. So, like, if you remember the film Paris Je T'aime, it was a bunch of directors' take on Paris. And there were two omnibus films at Tribeca this year, one that John just mentioned, another one called Madly, which was a bunch of directors' take on love. Gael Garcia Bernal contributed a film to that one, and so did Mia Wasikowska.
So according to Wikipedia, an anthology film is also known as an omnibus film, a package film, or a portmanteau film. So if you feel differently about that and you're out there on the interwebs, let us know, because maybe there is a difference and Wikipedia is wrong.
So Holiday's central theme was that each director, there was a series of, I think it was 8 holidays that they chose, and each director took on a different holiday. So it's kind of interesting in the sense that I talked to the producer, and he said it was sort of a mixing of genres between, like, holiday films and horror films. So, like, instead of just having one holiday film that you could watch, you know, during Christmas or Halloween or whatever, you could watch this one anthology film, like, every holiday. And some of the directors that contributed to that were Gary Shore, who directed Dracula Untold, which was, it was kind of crazy that he was at Tribeca and that he did this film, and also, you know, like, went from making this massive blockbuster back down to indie shorts. But he talks a bit about that on the podcast that was released last Monday. Sarah Dina Smith, Kevin Smith, and many others. And it was definitely an interesting watch. If you're a short film director, you should check it out. It's on VOD now.
Speaking of horror films, Tribeca has a midnight section, as do many festivals. And we had the director and producer of the film Here Alone on our previous podcast, the director Rod Blackhurst and the producer Noah Lang. I'm not going to say too much about the film because there's a 45-minute podcast and we say a lot about it there. But since we've recorded that, they took home the Narrative Audience Award, which often is rare for one of the genre films to take home the overall audience award for an entire section. So congratulations to Rod, also the writer David Eviltoft, and Noah.
I saw a horror film sort of unwittingly at 9:15 in the morning. I walked into it having had 3 cups of coffee, and wow. I was scared out of my mind. it was interesting, though, because, well, the film was called Lavender. It was directed by Ed Gast Donnelly, who I actually wound up interviewing afterwards, and he was reluctant to call it a horror film. He doesn't like the term horror, and he calls it horror with a capital H. He wanted to call his film a psychological thriller. And that's what I liked so much about this film, is that it definitely incorporated the elements of a horror film. Like, there was, you know, there was a hedge maze, there were children who said creepy things, and there were people jumping out from under beds. But it was definitely, it definitely all took place inside a woman's psychological experience.
Can I say one thing about that? So one of the directors on the Holidays podcast, Nicholas McCarthy, talked about how, you know, you have those certain tropes of genre, like the hedge maze and like this tiny kid with the little hands.
Let's get some clarification
The tiny kid with the little hands.
I guess I don't watch enough horror because I can't think of one
example. I'm afraid of the tiny kid with the big
hands.
Is
that like Kristen Wiig in that SNL skit with the tiny hands?
Yeah, like the sort of malformed child with incredibly small digits.
Not like
Donald
Trump.
I know what I'm dreaming about tonight.
God.
Anyways, you take those tropes and then you find one that you can make completely different to kind of screw with the audience's expectations. And that's what makes a successful horror film.
Yeah, and that was interesting. This one was actually like Memento meets Hide and Seek. If you remember Hide and Seek, it was actually a Robert De Niro film. But it was about a woman who had her family murdered when she was five.
She was five?
Yeah, but
okay.
How big were this woman's hands?
With you guys.
So Lavender actually starred Abby Cornish, who I haven't seen in a lot of films recently. I'm really obsessed with a film that she did when she was much younger called Somersault, which was an incredible indie film directed by a woman too. And she plays this woman who doesn't have memories of being a child, basically because a tragedy happened and in which her family was murdered, and she doesn't know what happened, whether she was partially responsible or any details surrounding the matter. So the entire film is her piecing together the memories, confronting her own demons, and basically traveling back into the past.
So we're talking about women a lot at Tribeca, but obviously women are not the only minority in the film festival. One of the favorite documentaries that I saw that I had a personal interest in was called Bad Rap. And it's a double meaning. It's not necessarily the rap itself, like the form of music is bad. It's the reputation of somebody. In this case, Bad Rap is about Asian American rappers. And you start off thinking you know the story, that it's about the challenges of breaking into an industry. But it actually explores a lot of other things. It was directed by Salima Kouroma. And it's really terrific. I hope it finds a larger audience, gets into sort of more of the vagaries of the music industry in general. It talks, of course, about Asian stereotypes and the way people view them, but it also goes into the difference between the way that Asian females and Asian males are perceived. Oftentimes, Asian females are very sexualized in the industry, and, you know, Asian men are not usually given a lot of masculinity. And as a guy who plays a testosterone-driven sport, as an Asian American basketball player, you know, the struggle is real. But I really recommend Bad Rap, and, you know, stay tuned for when that's coming out and where you'll be able to see it.
I'm glad you brought up documentaries, because as we've discussed on the show before, Tribeca is one of their strongest sort of longtime reputations is for programming good documentaries. And a couple episodes ago, we also talked about my interview with Andrew Kahn, who did Night School, which premiered at the festival this year. Did anybody else see any good docs?
Yeah, I actually saw one about the self-help guru, James Arthur Ray. I don't know if you remember what happened with him, but he was an international sensation, and he was found responsible for leading three people into a sweat lodge, who wound up actually dying from heat exposure from the experience. And that one, which was directed by Jenny Karchman, I found really interesting because while it didn't quite get into the psychology of James Arthur Ray, the character, it did bring up a lot of very interesting questions about ethics and the law's ability to hold people accountable for actions that wind up spiraling into disasters.
I saw Memories of a Penitent Heart by Cecilia Aldorando. She's also a New York-based director, but her family is from Puerto Rico, and she basically put the whole family through the ringer by telling what sort of became a pretty harrowing tale about how her uncle, who passed away when she was five, actually had AIDS and was in a gay relationship, which was quite controversial in the family's home country. And it's one of the only films that I heard of that actually got picked up at the festival. So POV will be broadcasting it. And usually I'm a little skeptical about personal documentaries, but in this case, it pointed to so many other big issues about the way that the HIV crisis was dealt with in the 80s that I think it'll actually resonate with a lot of people. And I thought it was beautifully done. You saw it too, right, Emily?
Yes. From a narrative standpoint, it really reminded me of Stories We Tell, in the sense that it started with, you know, a reason to explore personal history, and then it wound up uncovering revelation after revelation in this family's history, which pointed to bigger historical context, like you were saying. I don't want to give anything away, though.
I saw Contemporary Color, which is a concert film, I think, more than a documentary. I was kind of hoping we'd be able to see more of sort of the behind the scenes story about how this event got produced.
But what is this event, John?
This event, which I was getting to, which I will now speak of, was a Color Guard, a massive Color Guard production that David Byrne put on at Barclays Center a few years ago. I think it was actually last year, where certain artists, certain musicians created pieces based on like high school Color Guard groups' routines, and then they put on this massive show at Barclays. So it was a really interesting concert film directed by the Ross Brothers, and if you're a fan of sort of that David Byrne, St. Vincent sort of alternative music, then I think you could get into it.
Well, speaking of music, of course, there's not only documentaries about music, but in some cases narratives, and the opening narrative film of Tribeca was Kix. It's not explicitly a movie about a concert or a musician. It's more about a particular era and genre, in this case, 90s hip-hop. It was directed by Justin Tipping. It's his first feature, and it's a very well-made film about a kid who gets jumped for his Air Jordan sneakers, goes on a mission to retrieve them, and comes of age in the process. I interviewed Justin about his journey of going from being a filmmaker who had made a Student Academy Award-winning short to getting a feature made, which can often be a long journey, I will say, from experience, as well as the challenges of trying to find financing for a film with a predominantly African-American cast, which, when it comes to the way that movies are financed, being foreign pre-sales and star power, often has its share of particular challenges. So that interview will be coming to No Film School any day now.
And the Notorious B.I.G.'s son is the lead character in that.
He's not
right?
The lead. He's one of the other characters in it. The kids are all really great. The performances are great. And he played young Notorious B.I.G. in the movie Notorious. So he's an experienced actor.
Right,
but there's
right.
a mix of kids with acting experience and locals. It's about the Bay Area. They shot in Oakland. So you get a lot of local character to it. And some of the challenges that Justin faced will be challenges that I will face on my film Amateur, namely that when you're filming with a minor, you have limited number of hours per day. And, you know, with indies, you always have a limited number of days. So that just means you have to be working that much more quickly and efficiently.
Along the lines of the coming of age film, it wasn't a Tribeca premiere, but I did manage to squeeze in one film just for fun, not necessarily for work or because I had an interview lined up. But I saw Hunt for the Wilder People, which premiered at Sundance. And we spoke about it on the show a few weeks back, that it was basically the best performing, best box office performing film in New Zealand ever. And it's a New Zealand made film, and it was so cool and so much fun. So I just want to give it a little plug because I know that it got picked up by The Orchard in the US for theatrical distribution this summer. And it's another kind of coming of age film. I felt like I was watching a modern day Goonies, which is one of my all time favorites.
It's Taika Waititi, right?
Yeah.
I love him.
Yeah, he's awesome.
I actually don't know his other work. What else has he made?
He made Boy, which was I think he broke his own record for being the best performing film at the box office. His previous film, Boy, was the best performing.
And if you saw What We Do in the Shadows, the mockumentary about vampires with Jermaine Clement, he also did that.
Yeah,
and
one of the best, funniest movies I saw last year.
Hilarious film.
Yeah, it's really good. And so is Eagle versus Shark, which was, I think, one of his first movies, but also starring Jermaine Clement. So he's like a frequent Jermaine collaborator.
Clementer.
So, I mean, if you're a Flight of the Conkers fan, you should check out all of his films. They're awesome. And just one extra thing on top of that, Rooftop Films just announced its slate of films that it'll be showing over the summer. So if you do live in New York, you can go see Hunt for the Wilder People on a roof and Go Honest if you wanted to this summer. Those are always pretty fun.
So Rooftop Films is a New York institution. It's been around for a long time, shows a lot of great films. Tribeca, you could say the same thing about it. And of course, sometimes the Tribeca movies that are here, it makes a lot of sense for the programming team to pick things that are shot in, made by New Yorkers. And one of the films that I saw was called Wolves. It's written and directed by Bart Frohnlich. It stars Michael Shannon, Carla Gugino, and Taylor John Smith as a high school basketball star. Now, obviously, any movie about high school basketball, if you don't know that I'm making a movie about high school basketball, I wanted to go see. This one, it turns out, is about a white kid in New York City seeking a scholarship to Cornell. Very different story from my film Amateur. I thought they did a really great job with it. The basketball is realistic. A lot of the reviews are deeming it pretty cliched, but I personally find that film reviewers are very quick to call anything to do with sports cliched. Whereas other genres, like rom-coms or gangster movies, they wouldn't necessarily be as quick to point out that there are similarities between films. So I personally really enjoyed it, and the performances of the movie are the star to me. I think anyone who's directed a narrative and taken it from script to screen knows that you as a director are often making choices about whether you want to impose your visual style on the film or if you're prioritizing in both the direction and the editing room the performances. And in this case, I think it's pretty clear that Bart prioritized performances and they come across. Everyone is really good in it.
The only short that I saw this year at Tribeca was a short by Danny DeVito called Curmudgeons. You might have forgotten that Danny DeVito directed Matilda, so this is definitely not the first time he's taken on the director's role. The film itself was really, really, really sweet. It was about two curmudgeonly older Brooklyn men who fall in love at a nursing home, and neither of them was gay throughout their entire lives, so it was an unexpected turn for both of them. And it was interesting talking to Danny, who I interviewed at the festival, about why this story attracted him. And he talked about the sense that his sense of optimism never fades, no matter how old he gets, because he's always surprised by how life can surprise him.
I really enjoyed that interview, Emily, almost as much as I enjoyed the selfie that you took with Danny DeVito.
Yes, we took a selfie. We did, and it wasn't my idea, believe it or not.
What? Whose idea was it?
It was, I asked for a picture of him, and he took that to mean a picture with him and a selfie, which I didn't mind at all. I crouched down.
Are
and
you,
it was great.
Okay, so you're taller than he is?
I'm definitely taller than he is. We crouched, so it doesn't look too bad in the picture.
Awesome. I'm very jealous.
So just like every festival, Tribeca has a lot of happenings going on besides just films, and theirs are some of the more interesting. I mean, one of the things I think people feel about Tribeca is that it's film and filmmaker focused, but I think their definitions of what falls under the sort of film label are broader than some of the other festivals. So they have tons of interactive and virtual programming. They have a whole festival hub, this kind of building downtown that they dedicate to things like interactive programming. And like, for example, they're one of the only festivals that has in its lineup virtual reality films and what they call storyscapes, which are kind of like new frontier filmmaking and storytelling experiments that are carefully curated, just like they curate the films in the festival. So Sundance also has a New Frontiers section, but Tribeca is robust and goes on for days. Emily and I both saw several of the pieces that were part of the virtual arcade and storyscapes this year.
My favorite was a short, an animated short, which was about 20 minutes long, called Allumette, which took place in the sky. It was about a little girl who becomes homeless and finds her way navigating a lonely town in the sky. And it made me feel like I was a kid again. I didn't realize that in VR these days, one of the new things that you can do is you can actually view something from all angles, not just in a 360 formation. So you can walk within this prescribed square and look under and above things. So at one point, there's a ship that comes floating through the sky, and it's half open, sort of like a dollhouse. And I went up and I poked my head into each room, and each room was completely built out. It was absolutely beautiful.
So yeah, what Emily's saying, it's sort of hard to picture if you're not there, but a lot of these VR projects, you sit in a seat with the headset on and you sort of can turn your head around up and down and watch a film. And with something like Allumette, they actually built a space where you could physically walk with the headset on. And as you walked, you moved
through space.
It was a pretty special experience, but it also points to one of the drawbacks of this whole thing so far, which is that the film is 20 minutes long. And you have to have the physical space for it, and you have to have the headset, and you have to have a person standing there who makes sure you're not bumping into anything. And only one person can do it at a time. So anybody that wanted to watch that film, even if they were first in line, had to wait 20 minutes for someone else to be done with it.
It's a cumbersome experience.
Yeah, and I think I really admire Tribeca for trying to give platform and space to these projects, but it's really challenging. Storyscapes was up for 3 days. There were several projects there, and the one that actually won the interactive award at the festival this year was called Notes on Blindness. Everybody who got in to see it was talking about it, and I was dying to see it. I got on the waiting list, and I was told 2 hours. I came back in 2 hours, and I was told it's actually going to be 5.5 hours. And at 10 o'clock that night, which was 7 hours later than I had signed up, I got the text message saying, "Your slot is now available at Notes on Blindness." And guess what I didn't see? Notes on Blindness, because I was home in bed. That's a challenge, but this stuff is becoming more and more accessible. And I think what's so exciting about it is that filmmakers are really embracing these platforms as a way. I think for a while, VR and some of the other new storytelling platforms were just kind of gimmicks and things to play around with. And now, instead of like the story serving the technology is starting to serve the story. So in something like Allumette that we both saw, it really made the experience so much more magical. It made this animated experience so much more magical because we were able to actually be up in the clouds with the protagonist. There was another animated one called The Turning Forest. In that one, you can basically, you come face to face with this big dragon, kind of like the modern day version of Falcor from The Neverending Story. And ultimately, you get on his back and fly with him through.
That's amazing.
Yeah, through the sky, and you experience the adventure. But it's a story. It has a plot and a beginning, middle, and end. It's just that you are the protagonist. So filmmakers that are kind of willing to go there and let go of some of their preconceived notions of what a film means are really doing some interesting stuff.
I definitely saw an emphasis on empathy in the VR lineup. I was personally expecting a lot of dragons in a different sense, you know, like the Dungeons and Dragons video game type fare. But I saw a lot of filmmakers tackling, trying to get inside an experience, whether it was the experience of being blind or the experience of living in the Sahara Desert or the experience of being a homeless girl.
Yeah, I actually did a more in-depth interview on a piece called 6x9 that you can now see, not in installation form, but if you have a Google Cardboard. The Guardian newspaper just released it this week. Again, it's called 6x9, and it's a perfect example of a good use of VR for empathy building. It was a team of journalists worked with the Mill VFX house in London to create the experience of being in solitary confinement. And again, that's the perfect use of VR because the story is about space, and that space is a 6x9 cell. And it was actually terrifying. Like, it was more terrifying than some of the VR pieces I've done where you're doing something that's scary, like riding a roller coaster. Because even though you're, quote unquote, just sitting there, you're sitting there in solitary confinement. And the piece begins telling you that you'll be in here for 9 minutes, but some people are in here for years. It was really, really effective. And the filmmakers, or the creators in my interview, talk about all the considerations they had to make beyond those of a typical film in order to create an experience that had that kind of visceral feeling for audiences. I put up another piece overall where I controversially called it Advice from the Future of Filmmaking. And a lot of our readers, you guys, are saying, you know, VR is not the future of filmmaking. But I think the general point is just that you could look at this all as a gimmick, or you could look at these emerging forms as a way to, you know, think outside the frame and as an opportunity to push our own boundaries. So I think it's kind of an exciting moment.
This wasn't quite a VR film, but it was a 360-degree experience. I saw a 360 film called The Bomb, and it was a treatise on nuclear disarmament. It did not play at all like a propaganda documentary. It played like an immersive experience inside the atom bomb. And it was actually accompanied with a live musical score done by The Acid. And it was incredible. It was very affecting. The entire time you could feel the reverberations of the music in sync with the atom bomb exploding. And it was interesting to me because to people of my generation, we feel like nuclear disarmament is sort of an antiquated problem that's like a hangover from our parents' generation. But there are 15,000 nuclear weapons that exist in the world right now, and any one of them could have a detonation at any point. And it just really brought you inside the immediacy of this problem that I think a lot of people forget about.
So how did they display a 360-degree film?
It was in a theater with screens all around you. So you could walk around the experience, and it felt sort of like a movie amphitheater in a way, if the walls were all made of screens.
So where do you see that sort of format sort of playing out in settings that aren't the Tribeca Film Festival? Do you know what I mean? Like, how will people be able to go see this in, I don't know, like Oklahoma or like Kentucky?
Well, the museums used to have that, or some museums still have that. You know, it's like the planetarium where you can go in and they have the projection all around, and it's kind of more like it's like 360-degree IMAX. So I wonder if that's where you're going to start seeing some of that as museums move to be more digital and virtualized and acknowledging of that format, if that's sort of like the venue.
Do you think that film could be shown on something like the Google Cardboard, where it's like a personal experience, or it really has to be seen in like a big, larger-than-life venue?
I think it was more powerful seeing it live because when you're in that venue, you're with other people, you're experiencing it with them, and you're feeling the reverberations of the music and experiencing the music live.
You know, maybe it's not a bad thing. I mean, people are concerned about audiences leaving movie theaters and that the theatrical experience is changing because people have their own, you know, devices in their hand and their own huge TVs at home. And maybe part of the answer is having films be made as actual experiences where you, to get the full thing, you have to go and see it out somewhere. It's kind of interesting.
Well, that's where Smell-O-Vision comes in. It's the theaters are always trying to move the seat, or, you know, spray you with water when there's a wave on screen or whatever it is they can do. And we'll see how many of those things are actual draws and how many of them are gimmicks.
Right.
Because a lot of them have been gimmicks.
I bet you're glad that Nerdland was not Smell-O-Vision, John.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Probably. I like that kind of stuff. Not like farts, but just like... I like when artists sort of use disgusting things to make the audience uncomfortable. I think that's like a really good method of making a film stick with someone. So
you would have loved this this VR experience that neither Liz nor I got to try out, but it put you inside the experience of dying with smells and sights.
Whoa.
In a morgue.
Heavy.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's not just about wearing the goggles. We didn't go in, but we witnessed other people experiencing this project at Tribeca, where in order to view it, you actually had to lie down on a metal slab and be shut into a morgue drawer. I was terrified just watching people like do it.
Hmm. What was this called?
Celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths?
Yeah, you could experience with smells and sound an actual soundtrack, either JFK's death or Whitney Houston's death. God knows why someone put this together, but it's fascinating. Aside from VR, there are plenty of traditional talks and summits and that kind of thing. And I have to say, the Tribeca lineup this year was stellar. We were all kind of fighting over which panels we would actually go to because they were all so good.
I wound up being able to catch Andrea Arnold's talk at Tribeca this year. She did Fish Tank and Red Road, which are two of my favorite films. And it was very interesting because she's clearly the type of fearless filmmaker that should be admired because she doesn't care what people think about her or her work. She really just wants to get into the world and express herself. And that was sort of the biggest takeaway with her talk is that she was basically teaching people how to harness their own personal bravery in terms of bringing their ideas out into the world and just letting them be.
Yes, speaking of daring women, Tribeca had a whole day dedicated to us, I guess. They called it the Tribeca Daring Women's Summit, which you could argue is sort of condescending, but, you know, I think it was well-intended. And there were a lot of interesting speakers during the day, one of whom was Rosie Perez, who I think is easy to write off because she often plays kind of over-the-top characters. But her talk was so endearing. And a young woman in the audience asked Rosie about the casting process because she's an actress and she an actress of color, and she found that casting directors were always trying to pigeonhole her and put her in stereotypical roles. And Rosie Perez talked a lot about how that happened, especially at the beginning of her career. And I wrote down a quote because I thought she had such good advice for this woman. She said basically, no matter who they're casting for, you as the actor should try to find the humanity in the story and give dignity to your characters. She said, walk in that room and turn them out. Show them what you can do. You might not get that role because they want more of a stereotype, but they will remember you. And she actually recounted a personal experience in that same vein where she had met the casting director for Fearless several times, never got a role. The casting director ended up putting her in a role that was a true story about an Asian woman for whom they were casting an Italian-American, and they ended up hiring Rosie Perez, a Puerto Rican.
That's not even whitewashing, but...
The highlight of the entire festival for me, though, was a talk between Alfonso Cuarón and Emmanuel Lubezki, or Chivo, as he's known to friends and fans. These two are longtime collaborators and are responsible for some of the films that really made me want to be a filmmaker, most notably Y Tu Mamá También, which I saw early in college and was like, that's what I want to do. And Cuarón was already on the program, and so I knew that I had to be there. And then it was revealed later on that Chivo or Lubezki would actually be questioning Cuarón. So Chivo would be the one doing the questions. It was just a candid conversation between the two of them. They've been collaborating for like over 25 years since they were in film school. And actually, you all will appreciate this. One of the first things Chivo asked him sarcastically was, did you learn anything in film school? And they basically agreed that no, they did not, except that that's where they built their relationships and started working together. And I put up a post with, you know, several of the secrets that they revealed that basically could only come from two longtime friends talking like that. One of them, which I didn't know, maybe you guys did, is that Cuarón actually started out as the cinematographer and Chivo got his start as Cuarón's camera assistant. And now, of course, Cuarón is a internationally known director, and Chivo has gone on to become the only cinematographer to win 3 cinematography Oscars in a row for Gravity, Birdman, and The Revenant. So Emily and I both wrote up those talks, and we also have pieces up on the site from the talks with J.J. Abrams and Chris Rock and Joss Whedon, a masterclass with Catherine Hardwick, and several other filmmaker interviews and exclusive pieces from stuff we saw at the festival.
This is always an interesting time of the year, going from Sundance to South By to Tribeca. It's sort of a 1-2-3 punch. How did you guys feel about, now that you've been to many films and panels at each, you know, what did you think about Tribeca overall this year?
It's interesting. Tribeca has always been, and I think continued to be, a grab bag this year. There are so many films programmed. I think there are over 100. And on the one hand, it's really great to have a lineup that doesn't feel curated into oblivion. And then on the other hand, you wind up seeing a lot of films that you can't decide whether you liked or not. You know, you liked one element, you thought one element was really executed well, or you liked the topic, but you didn't necessarily like the execution. And that's in keeping with how I felt the festival was this year.
I've covered both South by Southwest and Tribeca for several years, and I'm still kind of processing this year's. We're still writing up some of our pieces, but I would say overall, first of all, I didn't learn until this podcast recording today that it was definitely a year for the weird. I love that. I think that it's exciting that they continue to experiment with VR and other new forms of storytelling. I think it's a great, strong festival, as we pointed out, for women and New York filmmakers. But I think the biggest takeaway for filmmakers overall this year is that it seems as though Tribeca is becoming more and more the place outside of Sundance domestically to launch your film. There were lots of premieres. There were lots of first-time filmmakers. I think it was like, we put it in last week's show, but I think it was more than 50 first-time filmmakers were in the lineup. And as we talked about during our South by Southwest coverage, it seemed, and by the way, this is coming from someone who has dreamed of having a film premiere at South by Southwest for like a decade. I'm not sure I would make that choice anymore. I think Tribeca in some ways is the place to launch because it's so much more focused on films and filmmakers, and the lineup is strong and the programmers really care. And I didn't go to one film that wasn't sold out.
Yeah, that's one of the things that South by is up against, because it's interactive and it's music and it's film, and maybe in some variation of that order with film always in third, film can often feel like a sidebar because all the cool kids are at music, all the rich people are at interactive. And then, Liz, you heard a quote at the festival. I think you told me about it. What did somebody say offhand?
Yeah, at the convention center at South by Southwest, I heard someone say, "Oh, there aren't any films this year? There were films last year." Meanwhile, there were hundreds of films this year. It just goes to show what a lack of promotion they had.
And I agreed. I felt like, obviously, I was only here for a few days before running off to the madness of NAB. But in those few days, the films that I saw, some of which are by choice because you really wanted to see them, and others are just scheduling related. You find out that you can fit something in. And that's often how you discover some really great surprises. I felt like the lineup was really strong this year at Tribeca. And so who knows, maybe having an American narrative section separately has helped. You know, filmmakers are often faced with a choice. If after the Sundance madness of acceptances and more often than not rejections, people look at where they want to premiere next. And sometimes there is some jockeying that goes on among festivals in terms of what is your, you know, what section would you premiere in and what the festival is going to do for you. And it feels like, you know, Tribeca was offering a home to many filmmakers that they felt would be better for their film than South by.
I think it won't fully make the transition until Tribeca becomes a place where a lot of distributors go to pick up films, which South by Southwest still seems to be. But really,
there's Sundance and then there's everybody else in terms of acquisitions. Toronto, but at South by and Tribeca, you know, we did a couple pieces at No Film School about how South by isn't an acquisitions festival, and I would say the same thing about Tribeca. But we'll see. I mean, there's still, the festival just ended, and oftentimes at these other festivals, the acquisitions all come out afterwards. They're not like the midnight condo deals, especially in New York City where there aren't really condos.
Exactly. A film that I saw last year at Tribeca, which was my favorite, it was called Men Go to Battle, actually got picked up, I think, 7 months after the festival and is just getting distributed this year. So I think I see it more as a launch pad into the world rather than a launch pad directly into distribution.
It's interesting. I mean, I don't know that we have any answers in that area, but I personally wonder what Tribeca could do to make it more of an acquisitions festival. South by is different from other festivals in the sense that they don't do special press screenings. You know, often at festivals you have what's called P&I, which is press and industry screenings, which is a way for people both on the distribution side and on the press side to see movies without, you know, getting rejected from premieres or screenings that are full. And Tribeca has that, and Sundance has that. But South By, you just get a pass and you go and you can see things with the audience. And sometimes that's actually a smarter approach, because if you're going to acquire a movie and you see it with a live audience and that audience is really into it, that's part of the magic of Sundance and how they are able to get these really hyped premieres and they hold the movies back. Whereas at Tribeca, I mean, a lot of us were watching screeners, we're going to the P&I screenings. It's just a different experience. I don't know what the answer is, but I think that would certainly help Tribeca if it did become more of an acquisitions destination.
Well, I can say just from the very limited experience that I've had, I went to Sundance for the first time this year. I went to Tribeca for the first time this year. But I've lived in New York for 8 years now. And I think that, you know, one of the inherent problems with having a festival in New York, a film festival in New York, is that there's so much other shit going on in New York at the time of the festival, just because it's New York. And whereas in Sundance, it's such a contained world. It's just people are thinking about film all the time. You know, they're going to screenings all the time. It's all they have on their mind. But if you're in New York, the destination really becomes the city itself, and not. And especially the way that Tribeca is laid out, where, you know, there's theaters all over the city.
It's not really Tribeca.
Yeah, it's not really Tribeca. It becomes more about the city itself, which was, I guess, one of the initial reasons why it was founded in the first place, was to, you know, build up Tribeca after 9/11 happened. But I think until they find a way to make New York less attractive as a city, it's not going to be as successful of a festival.
And it's successful as a festival because of New York in many ways,
right.
But it won't be as concentrated as something like Park City, where everyone who's in town is there for this specific reason, and it's you know, it's more of like this mad rush as opposed to Tribeca. Is how long? How long has it been going on?
2 weeks. Yeah.
I mean, I actually don't agree with you. Like you said, it would be it won't become a successful festival until those things happen, but it is a successful festival.
Right.
The fact that it can sell out every screening in New York really speaks to the good job they do of promoting it and, you know, making it attractive for audiences and filmmakers. So
I don't think I was saying it's not a successful film festival. Obviously, it's a successful film festival. I'm just saying, as far as like a place where film is sort of being continually worshipped, I did not feel that at Tribeca this year.
Mm.
You know, the screenings that I went to at Sundance, while, you know, none of the Tribeca screenings all of them may have been sold out, there weren't like 2-hour lines of people waiting to get in to go see these films, you know?
And Sundance is sort of outgrown Park City in a lot of ways. But actually, that's a good difference between South By and Tribeca, and maybe that's the reason it's becoming more of a destination, Tribeca is, mm-hmm. for filmmakers, is I was at a lot of empty screenings at South By, including mm-hmm. the world premiere of the film that won the grand jury prize, The Arbalest, mm-hmm. which was in the Vimeo Theater. There were probably 60 people in there and it seats 500.
Ouch.
So as a filmmaker, to have an experience like Rod and Noah did with Here Alone, mm-hmm. where tickets went on sale for 3 screenings of their movies, and 10 minutes later, they were all sold out. This is a DIY film that they made, that they had, you know, Tribeca was the first festival they submitted to, and now all of a sudden they've sold out 3 screenings and are adding a fourth. That's what you want as a filmmaker. You know, the nightmare is that you get into a festival, you go there, and you're begging people other than your friends and family to come to your world premiere. And that's wonderful that Tribeca was able to sell all these screenings out.
Yeah.
So yeah, it seems like overall, we as press and filmmakers and audiences found it to be a pretty strong year overall at Tribeca. And particularly, you know, they're doing a great job of trying to push new forms of storytelling and showcase not only new directors in traditional platforms, but traditional directors using new platforms.
So speaking of new ways of telling stories, traditionally on Indie Film Weekly, we do a tech gear section. Our entire podcast last week was basically that, as Micah Van Hove and I recapped 2 million square feet of tech and gear at NAB in Las Vegas. We recorded that podcast, however, right before I went in for a in-depth demo from Lytro, the light field photography company. And our conclusions about NAB, the podcast was titled something like, "Why NAB is the most comforting for filmmakers yet." Our conclusion was that it was very iterative and that the companies were building out the features of their existing equipment, which as an owner-operator of a camera is great. You don't want to buy something and then find out that it's obsolete shortly thereafter. Lytro is potentially changing cinematography forever. And there have been write-ups, they've shown some brief demo videos, but you really need to see what it is they're doing to understand how different it is than what we think of as traditional cinematography. So depending on when you're listening to this, we either just posted or are about to post an in-depth demo that I did with Lytro at NAB, which explains all of the things that are different. In brief, instead of taking a camera and getting a flat 2D image and making all of the choices in advance, including frame rate, shutter speed, focus, you can essentially change all of these things later. And I think a lot of people were up in arms about how that's taking away the creative intent of the artist and placing it in the hands of someone who might later muck with it, like a studio. But when you see this 25-minute demo, I think you'll see that cameras as we know them are going to change. And right now, Lytro is, like early computers, huge. It's like the size of a room. I don't even know how much it costs. It's very unwieldy, but Moore's Law and the path of technology is always going to make things smaller over time, more inexpensive over time. And if they can get this light field photography technology down to the size of a traditional cinema camera, which they say is exactly what they're working on, there's a really big question about whether cameras as we know them now are going to seem really antiquated. So go to No Film School, check out our in-depth piece on Lytro, and let us know what you think, because cinematography might have just changed at this year's NAB in a way that our podcast did not acknowledge because we had not seen their demo yet. This might actually go down as one of the most disruptive, most innovative NABs in a long time. So we'll see you on No Film School. Check out the demo.
And just when you thought cameras weren't going to change, I cannot wait to see the demo. I know you've been working hard on putting that together. So we also normally on the podcast have upcoming deadlines and events, and we're going to skip over that this week since we had so many other things to talk about, but I do have to give one shout out. John, Emily, and I all moved here to New York from the Bay Area, and we're right now in the middle of the San Francisco International Film Festival. I served for 3 years on the Golden Gate Awards jury for that festival, and it feels really close to my heart. The people we know who work there are awesome, and the festival runs from April 21st to May 5th, so if you're in California, you have about another week to go and check out some of the best programming of international films in this country. Highly recommended, and good luck to our friends out there.
Also, since we often do a opportunities and grants section, the Associated San Francisco Film Society, one of the best destinations to go to if you're looking for grants and opportunities. So if you're not able to make the festival, which is unfolding right now, definitely check out the San Francisco Film Society, their Filmmaker 360 program. They have residencies. That'll be our grants and opportunities section for the week. Just go check them out.
SFFS.org, San Francisco Film Society.org. And thank you so much, John and Emily, for joining us this week. And thanks in advance, John, for editing this beast of a show.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You all out there can read all of our interviews from Tribeca and coverage from the festival, as well as see this amazing Lytro's camera video that Ryan's been working on at nofilmschool.com.
And as always, please subscribe through whatever podcasting app you choose to use. But also, the really big thing that makes a difference for us is if you rate us in iTunes. There was a flurry around a couple weeks ago. We asked for people to rate us, and then all of a sudden we were in the top 10 of TV and film podcasts in iTunes. That makes a huge difference for us, for the future of this show and being able to bring new shows to our podcast channel. So please head to iTunes, give us a rating. And as always, thanks for listening.
See you next week.